Greetings to the crew. This is your nav speaking in the pre-dawn hours of December 22nd. It's around 5 o'clock a.m. I'm here on the navigation deck in my little writing room, facing out on the terrace where I look at the stars. Orion is just about getting ready to set. I see Sirius bright and strong at about 45 degree angle toward the west, and rising in the east are the star Spica in the left hand of the Virgin with the planet Saturn close by off to its left. In fact, Saturn is pretty much conjunct Spica right now, and it will remain in that position for 5 months because it's going into a retrograde cycle. In about an hour or 40 minutes, the sunrise crescent will appear in the east beneath Spica and Saturn. It will be located in the constellation of the Scales. That is the left-hand crescent. If you hold up your left hand, you see the form of the crescent because it's illuminated from below by the rising sun. I'm doing one of my Turton vigils, which is the four-night divination of the sunrise crescent. And that takes 4 hours, 4 to 6 hours of observation each evening. So that's the setting, and this is the moment when I want to try a new routine to present a new aspect of the Gaian navigation experiment. That is to say, quite simply, that I'm adding an oral or recorded commentary to go along with the crew notes. So I just sent out crew notes 14, titled Gaian Cosmology, Paradigm Collapse, Approaching the Ultimate Threat. And the purpose of this oral commentary is to go along with some points in that, in those notes, which I have now printed out and have in front of me so I can follow myself and exhibit some semblance of coherence and continuity, which, of course, is always extremely impressive. So let's proceed section by section, starting with the mythogenetic method. Here I reiterate the method that we use in the Gaian navigation experiment. The main tool is the nautical metaphor, and you will all be familiar with this by this time. If you go back to the first crew notes and to the invitation, I believe that I've set out the concept of the nautical metaphor and how it operates on several occasions over the last 6 months. So in these notes, I repeat that, and I cite a passage from metahistory.org, which includes that wonderful quotation from the alchemical compilation of Artis Auriferae. Nature performeth her operations gradually, and indeed I would have thee do the same. Let thy imagination be guided wholly by nature, and observe according to nature, through whom the substances regenerate themselves in the bowels of the earth. And imagine this with true and not with fantastic imagination. End quote. Absolutely fantastic piece of sacred instruction there. And as I explain and have explained in several other occasions, the difference between true and fantastic imagination is very simple. The Sophianic vision story is the only complete and coherent myth we have of planetary evolution. It is unique and superior to every other myth that has been produced by human imagination on this planet. Why? Because it is a myth about the planet. It is the only story, complete story of the planet, hence a planetary myth. And so within the framework of that story, the untold possibilities of the true imagination unfold. and the story guides and frames the operations of your imagination and mine, so that even though we're completely individual, different individuals with very different capacities and talents, tastes, predispositions, likes and dislikes, aesthetic criteria, as different as we may be and as vastly diverse as the expressions of our individual imaginations may be, we are unified and aligned by the guiding power of this vision story. It does not exclude the diversity, the immense diversity of imaginative expressions of our species, not at all. It allows for that diversity, but it holds that diversity within a unitary and cohesive framework. Campbell didn't know this. Campbell didn't have this story. He didn't have this myth in its restored form. And so he can be allowed to have made errors due to that immense omission. I just want to say that Campbell is often cited in certain respects as a pioneer of this navigation experiment. He wrote extensively of the mythogenetic moment of the 13th century and said that there might be a comparable mythogenetic moment at the dawn of the 21st century. Well, he was certainly right on that point, folks, because here we are living it. And I'm fairly certain that we're living it in this navigation experiment in planetary tantra and the terma of Gaia awakening. We are living it in ways that would have greatly surpassed his own capacity to predict, although he did predict this moment would come. Just having a sip of my morning coffee. I just want to point out one place in which Campbell was seriously wrong, however. Recall that he was a professor at Sarah Lawrence College. He was in academia. He was an extremely genial man with a fantastic body of knowledge on board and a tremendous scope of intellect. But he wrote a book, or there is a book, called Pathways to Bliss, which compiles some of his teachings and his lectures. And I would advise that none of you buy this book or even read it. It contains some of the worst notes that Campbell ever struck in his career and exemplifies some of his most unfortunate errors. I'll just point out one of those. I could stand here for several hours and go through this book page by page, pointing out where Campbell was seriously wrong. But I would just like to cover the first point. In chapter one, The Necessity of Rites, he defines the functions of mythology in this way. Quote, "Traditionally, the first function of a living mythology is to reconcile consciousness to the preconditions of its own existence, that is to say, to the nature of life," unquote. Well, that's pretty good so far. To reconcile your consciousness to the preconditions of the existence of your consciousness. Well, this is a general approach. Sounds pretty valid. But listen where he goes with that. Quote, "Now life lives on life. Its first law is, now I'll eat you, now you eat me. Quite something for consciousness to assimilate. This business of life living on life, on death, has been in process for billions of years before eyes opened and became aware of what was going on out there, long before Homo sapiens' appearance in the universe. The organs of life had evolved to depend on the death of others for their existence. These organs have impulses in which your consciousness isn't even aware. When it becomes aware of them, you become scared that this eat or be eaten horror is what you are." And he continues with this paragraph. "The impact of this horror on a sensitive consciousness is terrific. This monster, which is life. Life is a horrendous presence, and you wouldn't be here if it weren't for that. The first function of a mythological order has been to reconcile consciousness to this fact. End quote. Well, dear Mr. Campbell, I don't know if you can hear me from whatever dimension you are inhabiting right now, but I have to tell you on my personal testimony, not only of my ordinary state of consciousness, but also from altered states, that life, nature, the predisposition and precondition of my consciousness is not a horrendous presence. And to call it so is completely wrong-headed. I wouldn't even call it absurd. It is just so far off the mark that it's rather mind-boggling. What I see in nature, which provides the preconditions of my capacity to see nature, is eternal transmutation, eternal recycling of life through the symbiosis of life and death, involving in some measure the process of eat and be being eaten. But until you stand before the naked and obliterating beauty of the planet Earth, and it comes to you and threatens to eat you alive, and until you feel the bliss of wanting to be eaten alive and wanting to die into that very beauteous presence, then you're really not qualified to make these kind of grandiose statements. And I think it's extremely unfortunate that you would say such a thing, teach it to lovely young girls at Sarah Lawrence College who are going to carry, who probably have a crush on you and are going to carry this thought with them through their entire lives, not to mention the millions of other people that you reach through your books and your recorded interviews, such as The Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. So, Professor Campbell, seriously wrong on that count. We are now at the point of immersion in Gaia's correction, in Sophia's correction, where we as members of the planetary tribe, can formulate a Gaian ethics, which means for the first time, we can, out of our own resources, define agreements about behavior. And included in the framework of those agreements is the understanding that eat and be eaten is a very fair and beautiful form of symbiosis. Included in those agreements, which frame our ethics, is the understanding that the prey-predator relationship, the cheetah bringing down the gazelle, is a beautiful and ineluctably precious aspect of the symbiosis on this planet. And the day when we understand, as the human species, who are the ultimate predators, how we can willingly and respectfully abide by that same law of symbiosis, is the day our society will be reborn into an age of enlightenment, or at least a moment of enlightenment, because a moment is all we may have left. So I really wanted to point out to you, I could really dig into this even further. I mean, he goes into the story of C.G. Jung. He goes into the story of myth and the self and myths to live by. And he just doesn't have all the cards on the table here. But I'm not going to digress in that direction right now. Next, we move to the section of the current notes called Paradigm Collapse. Recall that I stated at the beginning of this experiment that we need to distinguish very carefully between what Sophia herself does in correction, particularly what she does in the realms of the human psyche, the collective unconscious, if you want to use the Jungian term, and what we ourselves can do, what is our role, our part. There is her role and there is our role, and we need to distinguish these two very, very carefully. doing so, we can make observations about how Sophia is proceeding in her activity of correction, because we know where to look. We have calculated expectations. We know how to anticipate certain things, certain events in the collective psyche. For instance, I said that what she does in correction is massively collapses or demolishes the archetypal structures or infrastructure that underlies human behavior. And so I comment further on this in this section on paradigm collapse. And I point out the remarkable and extremely bizarre and wonderful fact, which is well worth exploring, that there is a relationship between the anaerobic systems of nature and the psychic infrastructure of the human mind. You see, everything is material. Consciousness is material. The entire universe is material. There is nothing immaterial anywhere in the universe. Even the Shiva ground consciousness, the Parasamvit, or the ultimate ground awareness of infinite potential that provides the basis for anything to be conscious or for any act of attention to be performed, even that is material. And so one of the wonderful things that we acquire in the course of Gayan Tantra is the capacity to think materially and materialistically, but in an enlightened and shamanic manner, and in a mystical manner. I am a mystic who thinks materialistically, because to me, consciousness is totally material. I can tell you that not on the basis of speculation or assumption or some out-of-the-body adventure I had to the source of the universe. I can tell you that on the basis of my sensorial and cognitive observations in altered states, with the confirmation of those observations in my ordinary state of mind. That is to say, not in cognitive trance. If you go into cognitive trance, you learn many, many things. Cognitive trance is the mathesis. It is the method of learning of the telestai of the ancient mysteries. Those of you who are undertaking Gayan Tantra, those of you who intend to practice telestic shamanism, will, at one time or another, enter the practice of cognitive trance, ecstatic trance, as a higher form of learning and a higher form of attention, or heightened attention, as Castaneda called it. And when you do so, I can guarantee you that if you hold steady in gnosis, in cognitive trance, if you hold steady with eyes open, if you stay in your body, and if you are able to stand in the presence of the awesome beauty of this planet, she will show you, I assure you, that consciousness is entirely material. This is why we use the 10-tier experiment, because everything in the 10-tier experiment is, as it were, material. It's an observable component of the natural world. It's available to our senses. The mineral realm, the microbial molecular realm, to some degree, is not available to normal sense perception, but also in an altered state, you can see into the microbial and molecular realms. Shamans do it all the time. The plant realm and so on. All of these realms are sensorial and cognitive. They are all composed of living material. And each of them has a great deal to show us about the nature of consciousness, because there is no consciousness without matter, and there is no matter without consciousness. One of the teachings of Mayavada Vedanta, which is not Advaita Vedanta, but a far less known branch, One of the teachings of my Avadavedanta, which is my path, as it were, is that matter and consciousness are co-evil. They are co-emergent. They arise simultaneously, and there cannot be one without the other. There can be no matter without consciousness, and no consciousness without matter. So this is a wonderful thing to know directly. I'll tell you, it's a hell of a thrill when you are given that instruction, when you are shown that in the naked act of beholding. I would point out, by the way, that in ancient Greek, the ancient use of Greek in the mysteries, the word theoria, which is the basis of our word theory, meant beholding. So when you went into theoria in a mystery cell practice, you went into the deep beholding of the deep ecology of the materiality of all consciousness. And so that's a fantastic thing to learn, and it's one thing I can guarantee you is verifiable by your direct experience. There are some scientists who have, and some investigators whose names are known, who have had a natural tendency, even though they didn't know about the mysteries or telestic shamanism, to follow that approach to nature. One of them was Goethe, another of them was Wilhelm Reich. And so they become, as it were, the guides and forerunners of our practice in Planetary Tantra. Now, coming to the next topic is the electric universe. And I want to, I've proposed here something that you may discard. It's not essential. If you don't like it or you're uncomfortable with it, let it go. But I proposed a kind of scale model of a way to visualize the solar system by imagining the sun to be about an inch in diameter, like the size of a nickel or a euro, and then imagining that the plasma well in which the sun is the navel or belly button is about 750 feet in diameter, and that the planetary paths, which are not circular, by the way, but elliptical, move in that plasma well, and they are held together by the geometrical properties that are inherent to plasma. Now, this idea of the geometrical properties of plasma is a really fantastic thing to learn about, and suggest that you go and look at the talks on biogeometry by Ibrahim Karim. I've given the link there. And there are some really good clues and approaches to Sophianic cosmology in that material. Dumping Einstein. Okay, here's a place where I intended to insert a commentary. I'll try to keep it as concise as I can. Recently, we've heard that certain experiments in CERN defied the propositions stated in Special and General Relativity. That would be 1905 for special and 1910 or 11 for general, stated by Albert Einstein or by someone who was using him as a front. And so now the Einsteinian paradigm collapses. Well, we anticipate things like that, don't we? We can anticipate, without predicting, because that is not the game here, we can anticipate that the existing scientific paradigms that have been erected and foisted upon humanity over the last almost 200 years, since about 1820, are collapsing, and they will all collapse. So it's magnificent that the Einsteinian paradigm presented to us at about the midpoint of this 200-year period of abominable, misleading education and mind control would be collapsing in front of our eyes. But don't assume that the scientists who conducted the CERN experiments have a better paradigm. Their paradigm is just as bad as his. In fact, it's just a game of saying there are a number of people around the craps table playing craps, shooting craps, and one of them
points out that another player is playing with loaded dice and he's cheating. But the person who points out the cheater is also a cheater. So in this case, you know, the CERN paradigm, whatever paradigm they're using, which is probably quantum physics derived from the monstrous Max Planck, is going due to collapse as well. But it's wonderful and refreshing and very liberating and thrilling to me that the Einsteinian paradigm has collapsed, because I've been waiting since I was about 22 years old for that to happen. Just want to say briefly a little bit about my history with Einstein. I had two dreams of Einstein, which I might recount someday, and they were both lucid dreams. So I can say that I actually met Einstein in my life. Once I met him just a few days before he died, and I knew the day he died. There are reasons for that, because it was announced on the news, and I remember it very well. I was about 12 at the time, and I found myself at Einstein's house in Princeton. We had a particular conversation. I think it was almost 50 years later to the day that I had a second dream of him, and a lucid dream. So I've had a very intimate relationship in some respects with Albert Einstein. And I wanted to be an astronomer when I was young, inspired by Fred Hoyle's Frontiers of Astronomy. So even though I was of a romantic and poetic and mystical temperament, I was very attracted to astronomy. I wanted to become astronomer. Well, I guess I succeeded, didn't I? But not exactly in the manner I thought. Anyway, I was very interested in physics. I thought, well, astronomy, astrophysics, physics, Einstein, I better understand relativity, or I'm not going to be able to become an astronomer. I can't tell you how hard I tried to understand relativity, and I couldn't. And it just didn't make any sense. This idea, as I paraphrase it here, as it's often paraphrased, matter determines how space curves, space-time curves. You must always say space-time. Matter determines how space-time curves, and the curvature of space-time determines how matter moves within the framework of space-time. I thought, simple enough, right? Try to understand what that actually means. And bear in mind that there are 10 tensor equations possibly written by Einstein, possibly not, but attributed to him, that purport to explain in elegant mathematical terms just how all this works, but that's nothing but math. In fact, it doesn't work that way at all. But I'll tell you, when I broke away from the Einsteinian paradigm, even though I've never been able to refute it like we are now able to refute it with this recent breakthrough, I got really frustrated reading Einstein intensely in my late teens and early 20s. And when I think it was about 24 or something, yeah, it's about 24, I was living in Ellensburg, Washington, and I was had a job at a grain silo, and I was the guardian at the grain silo, and when the trucks would come with their grain, I would jump up on the trucks and I would pull down this nozzle, and then I would kick on the machine and I would feed the grain into the silos and then empty out the truck, and then another truck would come. So I worked at this job 8 or 10 hours a day, but the trucks didn't come all day long, so I had an enormous amount of time to read. So I used to lay there on a kind of cot in the shed attached to the grain silos and read. And I was reading Ernst Cassirer, The Philosophy of Symbolic Forms. And I was also reading another book by Ernst Cassirer. Ernst Cassirer, C-A-S-S-I-R-E-R, was a tremendous influence in my early years of approaching mythology, because it gave me the critical and deconstructive tools to know how to analyze the mythological evidence, which is what people like David Icke and Michael Tsasarian don't have, because they didn't do that particular homework. But I did a lot of homework with Cassirer and Durkheim and other people who you have to know in order to be able to evaluate the evidence presented by mythology. Mythology is the evidence of human imagination. And in order to be like a detective, you have to be able to evaluate the evidence. So I was fascinated with Ernst Cassirer from the time I was about 16, but particularly fascinated when I found out he wrote a book about Einstein. I thought, this is really hot, because Ernst Cassirer is an epistemologist, which means that he followed Kant, and he was very focused on the process by which we ask ourselves, the process that proceeds from asking ourselves this question: how is it possible that I know what I know? Epistemology is the science of deconstructing how we can know what we know, or how we can know anything at all. That was fascinating. Excuse me. So I thought, if Ernst Cassirer wrote a book about Einstein, this is going to be pretty hot. So he wrote, Einstein's theory of relativity considered from an epistemological point of view. And I used to lay there, 22, 23, 24-year-old kid, by the grain silos, reading this book, which I read at least 8 times. And this book liberated me entirely from the Einsteinian paradigm at that age, because it said something, Cassirer said something that nobody else ever said. And it was so obvious the moment he said it. He said that Einstein's theory of relativity, especially general relativity, which postulates this space-time interaction between space-time and matter, Einstein's general relativity is not a set of propositions about physics. It's not a set of propositions about the way the universe works. Cassirer said this, and he proved it. Well, what is it then? It's a set of propositions about how we measure the way the universe works. And so, the key to what Einsteinian relativity is about is not about the dynamics of the universe, the actual shaping of material bodies, the actual mysterious structures of space and time. It's not about any of that, although it appears to be. It's only about the formulas that are used based on measurements taken by clocks and rods, that is the jargon, to mathematically map those processes. So that is why I say that Einstein's theory is about the mensural properties of the cosmos, but not about the actual physical properties by which it operates. Ernst Cassirer explained this in this book, Einstein's Theory of Relativity Considered from an Epistemological Point of View, and it totally liberated me from the Einsteinian paradigm at the age of 23. Of course, it took me some number of years before I came to a cosmology that would satisfy me, that I consider to be truly contemporary and truly able to serve and guide us. But you know that I did come to that, and you know what that is. And I came to that through mysticism rather than through science. So I just wanted to point that out to you. I don't suggest that you go out and read Cassirer, but that is what he said. He said that the 10 tensor equations of Albert Einstein, which are so famous and considered to be the most beautiful propositions of mathematical elegance ever written. You have to be dining on lobsters and drinking champagne in order to even contemplate these equations. Do not say anything about the real physics of the universe. They just talk about the way that the mensural features of the universe fit a set of equations which then can be applied to the data that is measured. So they talk about the conformity between the mensural systems and the data that is measured. And so they're a perfect trap for mathematicians and people who are working on data and juggling fictional relationships without ever looking into the true physics of the universe. Good riddance, Albert. I may come revisit you at another time in a more gentle and compassionate manner if I have occasion to talk about our two dream encounters. So much for dumping Einstein. We move on. If you don't like my analogies about the solar system, that's fine. Don't get hung up on it. It's just a way of trying to show you that we're breaking out of the paradigm into a new visualization. The vortex of flushing water is very important, though. The solar system, with the sun and the planets is like a vortex of flushing water in which the planets, as if they were little round, little spheres of wood, are going down as the water flushes. But the thing is that they don't go down. They just continue to go around. And because the sun is moving, which is the sun, which is the focus of that vortex, is moving on a trajectory through interstellar space, it draws those paths of the planets into open spirals or screw lines. And this is the way, or one way, to visualize the physical solar system. And it's not the ultimate way. And at the end of correction, there will yet again be even a more beautiful, simple, and elegant view, a more simple and elegant visualization may come into view. Next we come to plasma cosmology. As I have said, plasma cosmology and EUT, the electric universe theory, are the best correlates to Sophianic cosmology. It's great good fortune for us in planetary tantra that plasma cosmology is breaking open all over the place, and that you can study it by clips on the internet and learn about it in a week or two. You can become current with plasma cosmology. Although, caution, there are certain essential elements of plasma cosmology in the electric universe that even the current proponents have not yet defined. And in some cases, they're humble enough to admit that. But I wish to point out a qualification. As plasma cosmology and the electric universe theory develop going forward in correction, they will provide ways to amplify and enrich the cosmological scenario of the Sophia mythos. The astronomy and the cosmology will be enriched and sharpened from these sciences, these emergent sciences. But in turn, these sciences will need to learn some things from the visionary practice and from the framework of the story. Now, I just want to point out one thing to you that's really a bit of a, to me it was, I don't know what to say, I won't say shocking, but it was, caught my attention. There is a YouTube clip with an interview with Dave Talbot, who's a proponent of plasma cosmology. And I have provided the link to the clip there. And I want to direct your attention to minute 440, where Talbot talks about the Mother Goddess. A bit stunned, that was the word that I was looking for. And you yourself may be a bit stunned when you hear Dave Talbot claim. Now, he's a cosmologist, he's an astrophysicist or whatever. He's talking about another genre, which is my turf, baby, mythology. So, you know, it's wonderful that plasma cosmology crosses genres and it incorporates mythology and shows that certain mythological symbols, such as the trident of Shiva, the trident of Neptune, which show up in petroglyphs and things of that sort, are actually illustrations of the activity of plasma formations that appear typically in a laboratory. This is wonderful. It means that some of the mythology and some of the mythological images we see around the world are representations of the activity of plasma and plasma physics. That's fantastic. The unity of physics and mythology, a beautiful marriage. However, I would point out that if these gentlemen are going to get involved in mythology, they need to be very careful to do their homework, because in this clip, Dave Talbot makes the preposterous claim that of the five known planets, and he quotes Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the one planet that is universally recognized to represent the Mother Goddess is what? Well, Venus, of course. Now, first of all, this is not true simply in the frame of the mythological material. It's not true. Venus is a love goddess. She's an erotic goddess. Aphrodite, Venus, and all of her correlates are sensual, and you can say that they are in a certain respect earthy. But anybody who would say that Venus is the planet that represents the mother goddess obviously has a very, very serious blind spot in their understanding of mythology. Because the evidence is absolutely universal and unquestionable that the planet associated with the mother goddess archetype is, of course, the Earth. So what a stunningly ridiculous thing to say. And it just shows you how far off someone can go, a well-intentioned person, when they don't master the material in the genre where they are dancing around, you see. The other thing I want to point out, apart from that stunning and particular stunning error, is that plasma cosmologists who talk extensively about mythology are at risk of making the same error that was made by Santayana and von Decken in Hamlet's Mill. You see, Santayana and von Decken wrote this tremendous book, Hamlet's Mill, which you'll find reviewed on metahistory.org among the classics for metahistorical study. And basically, it's a hugely long book, cumbersome, confused, and incoherent, in which they are making a proposition that can be said in one paragraph. And that is, very simply, they said this: oh, well, all the myths about the ages of the world, which are measured by the zodiac, like the Aryan age, the Piscean age, the Taurian age, and all the myths about the flood, which are run along with those myths, are really about an astronomical event, which is the sinking of various constellations below the horizon with the precession of the equinoxes. You see? And so they said, oh, myth is just encoded astronomy. And then they jumped from that insight, which is a valuable and correct insight, to a completely inaccurate generalization, which is that all myth is nothing but encoded astronomy. And that is not true. There is a category of astronomical myth, and I show in some article I wrote at the beginning of metahistory.org that there are 6 or 7 other categories which myth can describe. For instance, myth can describe natural processes in the natural world, can describe the evolution of certain plants. It can describe geological events. It can describe the arisal and disappearance of different species. And it can also describe the long-term or millennial history of our own species. So there are many, many things that myth describes. But to say, on the basis of one instance where the mythological material encodes astronomy, that all myth is nothing but astronomy encoded, is absolutely wrong. And so the plasma cosmologists face the risk of making the same kind of error that Santayana and von Decken made in Hamlet's Mill. That is to say, they are going to reduce all mythology, all mythological stories, themes, and images to descriptions or representations of plasma physics, and that is absolutely not correct. They would do better to do their homework, to be rigorous, and to select out of the massive body of cross-cultural world mythology those particular elements which do represent plasma physics, and to leave the rest of it alone. So that's my advice to them. Now we move on to the conclusion of the current crew notes, and we're getting to the meaty stuff here, because we come down to Beten Kaitos and the question of the ultimate threat. As I reiterate at the beginning of these notes, my friends, I set for us 2 challenges at the beginning of the Gaia navigation experiment, or 1 challenge that has 2 aspects. We are proceeding together using the lunar apogee and perigee surges in the constellations and the timing of those surges to investigate 2 questions. First is the question, what were the initial conditions of the pact that Sophia made with the human species when she dreamed up this experiment in the Pleroma before her plunge, that is, pre-archontically. She made a pact with us, and that pact, I have asserted, was involved an avataric descent or an intervention scenario, that she would intervene. She made a deal. The experiment would involve a certain risk, and she would intervene. And I have said that the version of her memory, a version of her memory of that pact, is contained in the myth of the chained woman Andromeda. And that the hero of that myth, Perseus, is actually the Kali or warrior aspect of Gaia herself. So Gaia, in some Kalika or warrior role, intervenes at the final moment in correction when the human species, when and if the human species is overcome by the threat. So the first question is, what were the initial conditions of this experiment? And secondly, more particularly, what is the nature of that ultimate threat to which she subjected us in order to make the experiment interesting? Because, you know, Pleromic aeons don't perform these experiments out of some kind of benevolent and omniscient gagahood and some kind of disinterested, detached viewpoint. They are disinterested and detached to the extent that, to a large degree, they don't interfere with the experiments they set up. They allow them to unfold on their own terms. But they take a great interest in the outcome of these experiments. And they gamble on them, actually, as far as I can tell. They kind of bet on how they'll turn out. And this is very interesting to them. So in order to make an experiment interesting, you load it with certain components of uncertainty, certain potential of novelty, and if you want to make it really interesting, you can load it with a particular risk. We don't quite know yet what that particular risk is, but we're getting very, very close to it. Now, I want to give you an update on the parameters of that disclosure, if I might steal a word from the current meme-ridden mentality of the alternative media and the ET people, ET UFO people. I propose that disclosure is not going to be an announcement by the authorities of the presence of extraterrestrial or non-human species on this planet. That's delusional. I propose to you that disclosure, nor will disclosure be an intervention of benevolent entities at the last moment to save us from our own folly. Now, you may wonder how I can deny that, because I'm saying something very close to that, aren't I? Well, no, not exactly. I mean, look at it. Look at it rigorously, my friends. Look at it rigorously. I'm not saying that the intervention of a superhuman, extra-human power to save our sorry asses is coming from space brothers or benevolent aliens or even benevolent humans from another civilization in this galaxy. I'm saying it's coming from her. It's coming from the Earth. It's not coming extraterrestrially. So she is here now at the core of this experiment. She hadn't intended that when she set up her intervention scenario. So she has to work out how she intervenes while she is at the same time dreaming and sustaining with her first and second attentions every single life process on the planet, including the processes of metabolism and respiration in your body that allow you to sit there listening to me talk and maintaining them in real time. So, occupied with those activities encompassing the entire biosphere, how is she now going to play out her original intention to intervene as a Kali or warrior figure? Well, this is what we're on board to find out. And if you stay on board the crew, I can pretty much guarantee you that you will find out by the time that correction is complete in March of 2014. March, April. May is the time to celebrate. So, here I've given a review of a timeline of the apogee surges. Because remember, we're tracing the apogee surges in the fishes. Above is the constellation of Andromeda, representing the mythology of Sophia's intervention in this experiment. And below is the constellation of Cetus, representing, this is the gamble we're taking, this is my best educated guess, the ultimate threat. We have seen the apogee move through the body of Cetus. And I would point out to you that the body of Cetus has two parts. I'm looking at it right here. One part of it is the big trunk, you know, the big trunk part, the lower part, which has the star Betanchaitos as sort of the belly or navel, the belly of the beast, as you were, or the bowels of the demon. And then there's kind of a stretch for the upper limbs. There's a star Mira, which marks a place on the thymus or chest of the monstrous Cetus figure. And then there are the five stars composing the head of Cetus, which represent the throat, five and the sixth star representing the throat, and stars in the head, which represent the mouth and the back of the head. Alpha Ceti, the brightest star in the constellation of Cetus, is actually positioned at the back of the head in the location of the reptilian brain, or the R-complex, which is a pun on Archon-plex. So, by watching the apogee move, scan the body of Cetus, we follow how Sophia, in her recapitulation of divine memory, recalls what the threat was that she factored into this experiment. And as she recalls it, we are able to retrieve it through an act of imagination. And through combining our imaginations as a group, just imagine there's more than 300 of us imagining the same thing. So, I scan some events in the past from May 27 on. We see the apogee in the lower torso of Cetus. We see it move in July 21st. It moved into the apsides of Jupiter. Then it moved ahead a little more, approaching the belly of Cetus and around. September, 15th of September, it aligned to Betanchaitos, the bowels of the monster Cetus, whatever this monstrous threat is. And it stalled there, and it's been stalled there for almost four months. And this sometimes happens with the apogee. It doesn't proceed. It always advances. Sometimes slightly drops back. But generally it advances, but it stalls. And we had this long stall, and we only came out of the stall finally around the 15th of December, just about a week ago. So we've been stalled at that point. And the shape and significance of external events reflects that stall. And you may have felt that the pace of events regarding the revelation of the social evil on this planet has picked up considerably in the last week or 10 days. And now it will be racing as we follow the apogee of the moon moving toward that satanic mask of Cetus, as I call it. So I give you the timeline here, looking ahead in 2012. Well, first of all, around the winter solstice, which is tomorrow, day after tomorrow, the lunar apogee aligns exactly with M31 and stays in that alignment till about the 15th of January. So we're in the key moment now for another 3 weeks, when the initial conditions, when Sophia remembers the pact that she made with us. What a tremendous moment. Attune your minds, align your imagination to that clue, and stay with it, and dream it, and contemplate it, and see what comes up. See what comes up. It can come up for any of us although I do intend to investigate it at a specific moment, telestically. So, following that, we move into 2012, and then we see that there is a very interesting interplay between Jupiter and the apogee of the moon, that they are kind of dancing around each other, and there's a certain point when Jupiter and the apogee of the moon converge. That's the most significant moment, and that would be on April 13th, 2012. And you will note that that occurs around 16 degrees of Taurus. And then there is another stalling of the apogee from March, end of March, into the middle of June. Thankfully, it's not a stalling for three and a half months like the one we've just come through. But it's a stalling that lasts about 2.5 months. And it stalls at around 1517 Taurus, which is right in front of the gaze of the satanic head of Cetus, and it is also aligned to Alpha City, or the star Menkar, which is the star at the back of the head, therefore representing the reptilian brain. So, remarkable things coming up. We could say that I'm not going to say what the threat is yet. I'm not going to say it until after January 15th. I don't know. I have some clues. I'm putting it together like a detective. It requires very intense and rigorous concentration to focus on it. I'm sure that many of you are doing the same as me in your own way, and according to your capacity and your comfort, your confidence at this point in the experiment. I know that I am certain that some of you are finding that your confidence is growing as you stay in this experiment and observe the story. Do not go out of the framework of the story. Go again, go back again and again to her biography, her story, because this is the framework of your imagination. And in that framework, you can achieve with your imagination things that you can't even imagine on your own. So we are really getting close to the first phase of understanding the ultimate threat, which will be completed by January 15th. And from then on, as I suggest, there is a phase two. And the phase two will be the time that extends more for about January 15th to June 15th. This is phase two of detecting and naming the ultimate threat. And as I said, the decisive moment of disclosure in that overall period would be Friday, April 13th, 2012. So this is a view of the agenda, of timing of our experiment. And it's been enjoyable for me to give you this oral commentary to go along with the crew notes. Right now I'm going to pop my head outside and see if the sunrise crescent has appeared. Hold on just a sec. Well, indeed, there it is. It's just about a thumb's width above the hills, slanting hills of the eastern horizon in the direction of Estepona. And this is also the moment of a perigee surge. The moon is large. The crescent moon, which is the left-hand crescent, is pretty thin. It's not at its ultimate thinness. I think tomorrow morning will be the last time I'll be able to see it. It will be almost too thin to see at that point. And it's placed in the left pan of the scales. So this is the first hit in the left pan of the scales, and the lunar surge will be occurring where I am in Andalusia in the next 6 to 8 hours. So I'm going to get out my lunar surge surfboard, or my whatever device it is I use to navigate that particular thing when I'm knocked out flat and horizontal and sleeping it off, and see where it takes me. So thank you all for being in the crew. I don't have words of gratitude great enough to tell you how wonderful it is for a Turton to have an entourage like you and to be able to address you all in the course of this fantastic experiment in rapture and learning. Safe passage.